Are you ready?
Activate.
Sequence start 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ignition.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark. And just like our intro says, are you ready? I really feel that tonight is going to be one of our most fascinating shows that you are probably going to have heard from us today. So I'm really excited about this, and that is going to be from our guest tonight is Roland Haas, and he is going to be talking about his secret life as a CIA assassin. So really a first for us here to have someone like this on the show, so I'm excited about it. I've listened to many interviews of Roland's and seen some of his videos up on YouTube, and I tell you, some really, really interesting stuff. So, but before we get to that, let's get a few things out of the way. And now, first off, of course, it is October, and it's Halloween. It's just right around the corner, and we're going to do a Halloween show just like we done last year. And again, we're asking for your input. We want to know, what do you want us to do? We really enjoy the listener interaction here, and to get y'all involved and help us decide what to do for special occasions. And well, our Halloween show is a special occasion, so we want you to let us know what you want us to do for that Halloween show. We want just your ideas, and the way to submit those ideas is just go to our website at www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com and click on forum. Now, we've started a forum a few months back, so you do have to register for the forum. It's free. We're not going to spam you. We're not going to sell your email address off to somebody, but that's just how, you know, we've decided to go with things here. And all you have to do is just post your idea. Excuse me there. And what we're going to do is whoever's idea that we choose will get a $15 gift certificate to our online store, which we also started just about a month ago. So, we've got a few items in there. We're really starting to build the products up that we have to offer in there. Many signed books from a lot of the authors that you hear on the show here, CDs, downloadable CDs, DVDs, so we're getting some stuff in there. So, whoever's idea we choose for the Halloween show gets a $15 gift certificate to that store. So, like I said, all you got to do, go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, click on forum, register, and post your idea. So I hope you'll do that. Hey, and even if you're not a member and you like forums, well, there you go. Join up and join the community. We have a nice little community here. So we would definitely love to have you. And, you know, while you're there, check out the store as well. We put a lot of work into that, so make sure to check that out. Well, let's get to a little bit of news that's going on around the world. A lot of it in the paranormal, a lot of it in archaeology. Got a little bit of everything tonight. So, of course, surely most of our listeners I know heard about the whole Bigfoot scandal that happened out of Georgia there. Well, if you didn't know, they're actually selling the original Bigfoot hoax body, the costume, on eBay. And it is being sold by Joshua P. Warren. And if you don't know who Joshua P. Warren is, well, he's the founder and, I guess, owner of Lemur, another paranormal research group. And believe it or not, this thing has about 2.5 hours left to go. And it is already at $250,000. Yes, you did hear me correctly. $250,000, $250,000. That is, I quite honestly, I find that just stunning. I mean, that is amazing that somebody's willing to pay $250,000 for that thing. But I guess now it's considered a piece of history in somebody's eye. But $250,000. So, go check it out on eBay. It's going to be ending here very, very soon. So we'll kind of maybe give an update as we close out the show here and, you know, see what it may be up to. Usually, you know, you get the bidding wars right near the end. So here we go, another story out of Geneva. Now, it seems the technical problem that forced the shutdown of the huge particle collider, of course, we all know this was CERN's LHC, seems to be faulty electrical connection between two of the accelerator's magnets. CERN announced that today, actually. Now, they were forced to shut down the LHC last month, only 10 days after starting it up due to a helium leak in its tunnel. The incident was unforeseen, CERN Director General Robert Amar said in a statement, but I am now confident that we can make the necessary prepares, ensure that a similar incident cannot happen in the future, and move forward to achieving our research objectives. CERN has already said that the collider will not start until next spring. Now, this is because it had to be warmed up from its operating temperature, which is minus 456.3 degrees Fahrenheit. So it had to be warm for them to be able to even investigate and do any repairs to it. Now, by the time it would be cooled back down again, well, it'd be time for CERN to run its annual winter maintenance. So, you know, I guess it'd be a long time to see if we see those mini black holes being created. All right, here's an interesting story right here. It was announced today that Italian archaeologists have discovered the tomb of the ancient Roman hero believed to have inspired Russell Crowe's character in the hit movie Gladiator. Marble beams and columns and carvings first emerged from the Roman soil during construction work to build a residential complex. According to Cristino Raneria, I hope I pronounced that right, an archaeologist who led the excavation at the site, the huge fragments belong to a monumental marble tomb built on the banks of the Tiber River at the end of the 2nd century A.D. Further excavation revealed a huge marble inscription that declares that the tomb belonged to Marcus Macrinus, a general and consul who achieved major victories in military campaigns for Antoninus Pius, the Roman emperor from 138 to 161 A.D., and Marcus Aurelius, the emperor from 161 to 180 A.D. Although the tomb collapsed long ago, the marble blocks are intact and perfectly preserved by the Tiber's mud. Rossi said that reassembling them should not be a difficult task at all. While the construction work for the residential complex has been halted, Rome's official plan to first reassemble the tomb in a 3D model and then fully reconstruct it as the centerpiece of public archaeological display now underway in the area. So that's very interesting. You know, there we go. Something to connect to the movie Gladiator, which was a good movie. I enjoyed it. There you go, our last story of the night. And I guess the question is being posed, are magnetic changes around the globe enhancing paranormal phenomena? After modeling 9 years of spot-on satellite data published in a recent edition of Nature Geoscience, geophysicists now say that frequent changes in the churning movements of Earth's liquid outer core could be weakening our planet's magnetic field. National Geographic reported earlier today that Danish geophysicists who co-authored the study have commented on the strange, surprising way that changes appear to take place in the Earth's magnetosphere in various parts of the world. This has prompted some to ponder whether or not paranormal phenomenon might be triggered by such activity, and even if the Mayans might have been correct about their doomsday theories for the ever steadily approaching 2012. So yeah, it makes you wonder about things. You know, local here for me, you got the brown mountain lights, the lights that appear over the mountains. It makes you wonder if maybe, you know, some of this, you know, the magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field being you know, having some changes is really causing some paranormal activity. And hey, if you've done paranormal research, if you follow stuff like ghost hunters, well, you know, they're always searching for, you know, spikes in EMF, magnetic fields. So electromagnetic fields, same thing. So very interesting, kind of thought there. Well, let's take a quick little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking with, Roland Haas, sorry about that. And this is going to be very interesting. I mean, if you've not heard his story before, you're just going to be amazed. So, you know, stay tuned. We're going to be back in just a moment.
Want more from Shadows in the Dark? Visit our website and sign up for our free newsletter. Become a member in our forum and check out our online store. Just visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. Where the darkness is illuminated.
While at Purdue University on NROTC scholarship in 1971, Roland was recruited to become a CIA deep clandestine operative. He underwent intensive training to prepare for insertion into hostile areas, including high-altitude, low-opening, parachuting, and weapons instruction. In the course of his first mission, he assassinated several international drug dealers. On his return, he was thrown into an Iranian prison where he was physically and psychologically tortured. Roland, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, and I tell you, I mean, like, you know, I mentioned earlier, this is a kind of a first for us to have this kind of show, and I tell you, I mean, I just find some of this just very interesting and curious at the same time to exactly what you had to go through and how this all came to be. So I guess the first is to just tell us a little bit more about yourself other than what I read briefly there off your bio.
Okay, I'm the son of German immigrants, came over soon after World War II. And they settled in Buffalo, New York. Now, being a kid in Buffalo, New York, right after World War II, especially a kid who spoke no English, was a pretty rough thing. My parents didn't have much money. They settled in a very low-class, low-rent neighborhood. And kids back then wanted to do what their parents did during the war, which was kill a Nazi. Well, as I looked around, I was the only one available. So I was pretty much beaten up every day of my life from the age of 5 or 6 on through 13. I literally had to slink out of the house to go anywhere and hide, you know, go from tree to tree, car to car, whatever. So one of the effects of that was, well, I figure I'm a little bit smarter than Pavlov's dogs. And when I soon figured out that if I opened my mouth, I'd get beaten up, I learned to keep my mouth shut. That started at a very early age. I just didn't talk to anybody. And what I did instead was I spent an awful lot of time reading and trying to develop myself in various sports because I figured if I couldn't physically beat these people who were attacking me, I would do it my own way. I would become bigger, better, faster, smarter, whatever it took. And then that was to be my own little personal revenge in life. So that's pretty much the way I grew up, a total loner, didn't speak to anybody, just in my own, living in myself.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, I guess that was rough. Like I said, I mean, it's right after the war, and I mean, you know, and so you were kind of, you know, everybody seen you as a Nazi, more or less, right?
They did. And, you know, it made sense, and there were shows on TV about that. And again, everybody wanted to do what their fathers did.
Yeah.
And kids can be pretty cruel, especially to other kids, and that's definitely the way it happened with me.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have, you know, taken your life, and I'm, you know, assuming that it's from, you know, explain some of your childhood and you know, your time as a CIA assassin, and you've put this in a book, Enter the Past 10 Minutes. Is that correct?
That's true.
Tell us a little bit about that and why you decided to, I guess, more or less come out and talk about this.
Well, there were a number of reasons I wrote the book. First of all, it was to be cathartic because for over 30 years I lived that life. And I, not that I wanted to talk to anybody, but I simply could not talk to anybody. I couldn't talk to my wife about what I did. I couldn't talk to family about what I did. So it all stayed pretty much bottled up. It got to the point where it was getting time to retire. I'm 56 now, and I go back to the agency and ask them what my retirement looks like, and they flat out tell me there is no retirement because paying me a retirement is an acknowledgement of my service.
Right.
So I asked them, well, what is it I'm expected to do? How am I supposed to make a living? And they just looked at me and said, well, we hear Kmart's hiring.
Oh, gosh.
Now, after 30, 35 years of nearly being killed several times and killing for this agency, I'm told that, and I've got nothing against Kmart, but it just didn't seem like a very fair trade-off for what I'd done.
Right.
I realized at that point that my retirement was in my own hands. And again, going back to my original self and getting revenge my way, I thought I'd write a book. And I wrote it in 90 days. I sat down and wrote it. I had an agent within a week, and I had a publisher in another week. So it's been very good along those lines.
Wow, yeah, 90 days. Well, I wish I could write a book in 90 days.
Well, I didn't see if this were a novel, it would have been a whole much more complex thing, because I'd have to come up with scenarios, people, descriptions of places. This was all this I just all regurgitated in the big brain dump and then went through and edited it.
Right, and that's, you know, that's definitely you know, an important thing to tell our listeners, is that we are talking about factual stuff. This was your life.
This is very much true, yes.
Yeah. Now, why, you know, well, you kind of explained why you decided to kind of come out and tell it. You know, I guess the other question would be, how can you? I mean, was you not afraid that, you know, there might be some kind of retaliation from the CIA or, you know, any problems like that?
Well, I wrote the book under the mentorship of a person who did the same, a lot of what I did, but he did it earlier than I did. He was actually America's first special operations soldier, a man named Ben Malcolm. And he did this stuff in Korea. He was actually stationed behind North Korean lines during the Korean War, something the U.S. government never admitted. Now, his dual life was, his cover was, he was in the Army as an officer, and he worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. He also wrote a book, and he went through 4 or 5 years of asking permission and constantly getting rejected. And what he told me was simply, he said, "Roland, the agency has 3 options in dealing with you if you write a book. One is to ignore you and hope no one buys the book and then you just quietly fade away. The second is to come right out and call you a liar and hope you don't have proof." And, you know, I did keep a lot of proof.
Mm-hmm.
"And third is to prosecute you to keep you from publishing. However, if they do that and the book does eventually get published, they will have turned you into a best-selling author by that action."
All right.
So far they've taken the benign neglect approach. People have written to them. I've been on many TV shows, Book TV and BBC across England, and they've tried to write for verification about me, and the CIA refuses to comment. They refuse to deny me or accept me. They do not acknowledge and they do not deny.
So what kind of reasons have you heard that they're giving? I mean, they just no comment at all?
From the CIA, no comment at all.
Hmm.
Now, what is interesting is that when I first started writing the book, and I sent a copy of it went to the CIA through my publisher also.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the CIA was still very steadfast in their denial of ever having involved itself in political assassination. Their line was, it was illegal, there are laws against doing that, we follow American laws, we wouldn't do anything like that. A month before I published, the CIA went public with the fact that, yes, indeed, we did do these things sometimes in the 70s, but it was a long time ago and we've never done it again. It was kind of just a little bit of a give, I guess, kind of to take some of the punch out of my book.
Right.
But they did go public with it, and they called it the release of, I believe, the family jewels.
Right, yes. Yeah, the family jewels, very, very familiar with that. So now, when did you start this with the CIA, just to kind of put us a start date on it?
Okay, 1970, I went to Purdue, freshman, and as you already said, I went on a Naval ROTC scholarship. And when you're part of the Naval ROTC, you have the option of going Marine Corps or Navy. Now, I was a very gung-ho young man, and when my parents first landed in the United States, my father was really grateful for having been taken by the states. And so the first thing he did is he joined the New York National Guard to kind of give back. Mm-hmm. And I did this, the whole military route, kind of in for my father, among other things, to do what he did, to say thank you to the country. And I was, like I said, I was very gung-ho. So I had taken the Marine Corps option. And as far as I knew back in 1970, the only job description for a Marine Corps officer, especially with Vietnam raging, was bullet catcher.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was, partway through my first year, my freshman year, I was approached by someone, again, in the ROTC, told me the commander wanted to see me in his office. Now, if you're at all familiar with the military structure, when the top guy on the totem pole wants to see the bottom guy, which was me, it never bodes well.
Right.
So all the way over to the office, I kept thinking, okay, what is it I'm about to get chewed out for? And I came up with all kinds of reasons. But when I got there, he simply said that someone from Washington wanted to talk to me and took me to an office, and sure enough, there was a gentleman who had my military file in front of him. Now, when you apply for ROTC or to go to any of the military academies, you undergo a barrage of tests, mental, physical, psychological, etc. And he had the results of all of that in front of him. I spoke fluent German, because I spoke German before I spoke English.
Mm-hmm.
I spoke Russian. I was a champion high diver, swimmer, gymnast. I'd done weightlifting and eventually worked myself up to the top 10 in the country as a power lifter. And I'd started martial arts very young. Again, all of this was a reaction to the, was self-preservation due to the way I'd grown up. So he had the results of all of that. But what was most important to him is that I was a loner.
Right.
I couldn't talk. I could keep things quiet. And he said very simply to me, Roland, we think you can do more for your country out of uniform than you can if you were in the military. Now understand, you're talking to a kid who was never picked for any sports team in school, always last, never went on a date, never went to dances, and here we've got a guy from Washington, D.C., sitting there and telling me, we think that you, Roland Haas, can do more for this country out of uniform than you can in. Just imagine the hook that was to a young guy who really only wanted acceptance and to be part of a group.
Mm-hmm.
And here he was saying, I couldn't be a part of a team. They're not looking at a team. They're looking at me to do something for them. I was sold immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Even though at that point, you know, I really had no concept of what intelligence or espionage meant. To me, as it is probably with a lot of people, the only image I had was of James Bond.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I'm thinking to myself, okay, what does Bond do? Well, he drives hot cars, drinks martini shaken, not stirred, and he has an endless supply of naked Russian spies jumping in and out of his bed.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I can do this. Now, unfortunately, the naked Russian spies never showed up, but I'm sure they'll show up for the movie, which is being planned now, and I'm just going to sit there in the audience thinking, damn, I wish I could remember that. but that's how I got started.
Right, right. Wow. Now, you know, being this, I guess, loner, you know, when you talked about this, you know, hard childhood, what was kind of your mentality as well?
Well, my mentality was, again, due to the hard childhood, that I really didn't have any respect for human life because I'd grown up thinking nobody had absolutely any respect for mine. At the age of 8, I had my appendix kicked in and ruptured.
Oh.
Almost died there on the street. One time, you know, the neighborhood kids literally captured me, tied me up, and put me on trial for being a Nazi, and they sentenced me to death. They opened up a manhole cover and threw me down the sewer and put the cover back on.
My God.
Had one of the guys not freaked out and told his father, that's where I would have died. I had one friend. After Buffalo, we moved to Cleveland, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland, Lakewood. I had one friend that I could talk to. And one day, some other kids from school were coming by, and they saw him talking to me, and they started riding in. What are you doing with this freak? Don't you know he's a Nazi, et cetera, et cetera? So, in order to gain their good graces, he turned to me and spit in my eye. Well, this was winter. I picked up an ice pick, one of these big chopping things they had, and I buried it into his side. I just didn't think. I just saw red. Now, he had a snowsuit on. I didn't do him any damage, but damage was the furthest thing from my mind. I really didn't care at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they figured that I already had the mentality that would accept doing what they had in store for me to do. That's one of the biggest problems with training somebody for this line of work. You can train someone to jump out of airplanes. You can train someone how to use weapons. But to actually carry through on an assassination, on an act, that's not something just anybody can or would even want to do.
Well, I tell you what, Roland, we've gotten a caller on the line, so you mind taking a call right fast?
Not at all.
All right, well, let's see if we get him on. So, caller, you're on Shadows in the Dark. What's your name and where are you from?
Hey, what's going on?
Hey, what's your name?
Oh, my name is Nico Brown.
All right, you got a question for Roland?
Hey, man, you know, I just wanted to know, man, you know, about you having this secret for a long time.
Yes.
What would you say to the younger people that's experiencing different changes in their life?
Now, again, I'm getting this third hand over a phone. I'm not sure I quite understood the question. Can someone repeat it for me?
Yeah, go repeat it again, because I quite didn't catch it myself.
Well, I was saying, you know, what would you, you know, tell somebody that's a younger person, you know, about your experience?
Okay, did you get it that time, Roland?
What, did I ever tell anybody?
No, what would you tell a younger person about your experiences?
Well, first of all, what I did, the job I eventually took on, I thought was a very necessary one. It had to be done. It had to be done by somebody. And I was in the mental state, physical state, psychological state to be able to do that. I would never, ever advise my children to go into something like that because it has a lasting effect. And the agency also has a policy that if somebody wants to go into this line of work, they're not going to even touch them. This is the kind of thing where they find you. You don't go into them. If you go into them and say, hey, look, I'd like to become an assassin, I'd like international intrigue, they look at you as trouble.
Right.
You're someone who's looking to make a name for themselves, or someone who is actually living in the fantasy world of James Bond, or these days, Jason Bourne, and that's just not the way it works. So I would tell a young person that if this is what you want, don't apply for this. You know, get into the agency possibly in another way. Become an analyst, whatever, and maybe prove yourself in other ways. And maybe, although it's a long shot, because like I said, they're very careful in the way they vet their undercover operatives.
Mm-hmm. And while we're kind of along that line of questions, we had a question from Arcamp in the chat room asking, does the CIA only take second or third generation Americans?
No, absolutely not. There are people in there who are first generation. Now, that's become a little bit more problematic recently, because the conflicts recently have to do with Al-Qaeda and things like that, and you're dealing with a totally different kind of mentality. These are people who would never, ever, ever sell out their leadership because it's a matter of religion and it's a matter of national pride. No amount of money is going to make them do that. So it takes a lot longer these days to vet a first-generation Arabic speaker or ex-Arab native to put them in this line of work. Unfortunately, you have to do it because it's really difficult to go into places like Afghanistan and Pakistan these days as an American, you know, looking like I do. I had blonde hair and blue eyes, and guess what? You know, I can't pass for anybody except German or American.
Right.
Back then when I operated, it was a lot easier because, well, this was the 70s. I started in the 70s, and Iran, everybody in the Middle East, Afghanistan, they were allies of the U.S. And there was a thing going on called the Hippie Trail, which was made popular by the Beatles, who had a spiritual guru, the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody wanted to be like the Beatles. And so hippies started hitchhiking to India to join an ashram or to attach themselves to a guru and gain spiritual enlightenment. There were thousands of them on the road, which made it easy for me to blend in.
Mm-hmm.
That just doesn't exist anymore.
All right. Now, you know, writing the book, Enter the Past Tense, was this also another way for you to kind of, I guess, cleanse yourself, I guess? I mean, did you have, you know, guilt or anything for the things you've done? Or, you know, was this a way to kind of put it out there? You know, it's kind of along the lines of talking about, you know, things that you have bottled up as a way to kind of release it.
Absolutely. Like I said, I wrote the book for one reason, because I had been shunned by the agency, but the other reasons were I needed catharsis. and the book was very cathartic for me. It put out there what I'd been through, and that served two purposes. First of all, it let my family know what I had done for all these years, and it would have been a real shame to have died and not had them know that, you know, this is what I did for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, what you just mentioned, the guilt part, it got to the point after doing this for 30-some years where I could not go to sleep at night. I mean, it was literally just eating me up every night, just ghost images, you know, things I'd done and, you know, faces, and it's very hard to explain. But to escape that, I started taking a shot of vodka every night. Now, I hate vodka, but guess what? It put me to sleep. But after a while, that one shot didn't put me to sleep. Then I had to take two. Then I had to take three, four. And so it went till it got to the point where I could drink an entire bottle of vodka in the hour before going to bed. I didn't go to sleep. I passed out. And I'd become a full-blown alcoholic. I got up one night for a drink of water. At least that's what I tell myself. It was probably for another drink of vodka.
Mm-hmm.
I missed the top step going down to the first floor, and I went head first, broke my arm, several ribs, most of the bones in my face, ended up in a coma in a hospital here in Atlanta for a month. And after I got out of that, I checked myself into a rehab, and, you know, it's been 5 years since I've touched any mind-altering thing, and I feel just fine because I've worked out my ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, it just, yeah, it really did get to me, and the book was very cathartic. Get it out there and let people know, this is what I did, this is what it did to me. I'm not looking for pity, by the way, because I chose this lifestyle.
Right.
But just putting it out there.
Now, excuse me there. Let's kind of go back to when you got into this, that they approached you and asked you to be part of it, and kind of, you know, work ourselves up and what you exactly had to go through in terms of training. So, I mean, you had mentioned, you were at Purdue and, you know, they approached you and, you know, you said you had, great test scores, high test scores, correct?
Right.
So,
and again, I've done very well athletically, and yeah.
Okay. So what was after that? Once they approached you and, you know, kind of, I guess, told you this is what they wanted you to do.
Okay. Well, first of all, they were never clear what I would end up doing. It
mm-hmm.
was just generally put to me working for the Central Intelligence Agency, working in covert operations, intelligence, espionage, things like this. What I started doing, and being a college student, especially with an ROTC scholarship, was a perfect cover for this because, first of all, in the summer, I owed the Navy 2 weeks, which I did on a cruise, an old oiler in the naval fleet. But the rest of the summer, I belonged to the agency. And the initial training was going from regular parachuting to the high-altitude stuff, high-altitude high-opening, high-altitude low-opening. And what we're talking about there, for those that don't understand that, is you're jumping out at about 32, 35, 37,000 feet, which is a height where normally your eyeballs freeze and pop.
Right.
You cannot breathe. You need special equipment, in other words, to do. And the reason they do this that high is because if they want to insert you into a country without going into that country's airspace, for instance, I did a lot of work behind the Iron Curtain in East Germany. They could fly along the border of Germany in East Germany, drop me from 37,000 feet, and you can drift in 30 to 50 miles. So you've got a good insertion that way without, again, causing an international incident.
All right.
And along with the parachuting, then, of course, came the weapons familiarization, the self-defense, and not only defense, but offense, knives, what they call fixed blade, fighting and defensive movements, and then, of course, weapons like the pistols, things like that. So that's what I did for about 10 weeks that first summer, and the rest of the time, especially when school came back in session, I was reading things. They kept feeding me things about the Middle East, culture, background, language, about the European East Bloc, again, culture, things that you would expect to see, the way you would answer questions, just getting familiar with the way of life in these other countries. And it was the second semester of my sophomore year where they told me that it was time to really go to work. Now, this came as a shock because, again, up till this point, it was all theoretical to me. It was still a game. I was playing along. I was having a great time, but I never really thought of consequences. And I asked them, what does that mean? They said, well, we're going to have to, you're going to be based out of Europe, out of Germany, so we need you out of Purdue and out of the Naval ROTC, your commission. I said, so I have to resign? I said, oh, no. To give you the kind of street credibility you're going to need for what we need you to do, we need you arrested. We need you thrown out of the university. We need you to get a dishonorable discharge. You need to be drummed out as far as possible. And now that came as a real shock. Because, mm-hmm. again, like I said, my parents were German immigrants. And if anybody out there has a European mother or family, what they like to do is they get together weekends and brag about their kids.
Right.
What's Eric doing? What's Peggy doing? Et cetera, et cetera. And I was about to take that away from my parents. And I didn't like the thought of being arrested or being thrown out of school. I said, so what do I do? They handed me a camera. It was, I believe, a Mamiya C330, the old double-lens reflex, a little box camera. It belonged to the Naval Public Affairs Officer.
Mm-hmm.
They gave me an address in Indianapolis, which is south of Purdue, and they told me to go down to this address, which is a pawn shop, pawn the camera, come back and wait. I will be arrested, and everything else will just happen accordingly. I did that. I came back, and I waited, and I waited, and I waited. It seems I couldn't even get myself arrested. It didn't help me either. After waiting a while longer, I finally just walked into the police station and said, do you guys have a report of a missing camera? You know, I took it, and it's really been bothering me. My conscience won't let me live with it. I'm here to turn myself in. And they threw me out of the police station because they thought I was crazy. But they had the good sense to at least check up on my story. Sure enough, the camera was missing. Sure enough, it was in the pawn shop. Sure enough, it was my signature. And sure enough, they arrested me. I'm in jail. I call my parents because I need to get bailed out. And that moment crushed them. I mean, I had taken away. I was the kid in the family who'd gone the farthest. And I had just destroyed that for them. And one of the biggest regrets I have is that both parents died without ever knowing what I had actually done.
Right.
That really bothered me a lot. Now, before anyone thinks, you know, we're talking to a convicted felon here, interestingly enough, after my first round of missions in the Middle East, when I came back to the States, all of a sudden, I didn't have a police record. Purdue University welcomed me back in, gave me a full scholarship, and made me a dorm counselor, which you don't do with convicted anybody.
Yeah.
And everything was hunky, and I got an honorable discharge from the Navy.
Wow.
So it's amazing, you know, what they can do to manipulate records.
Yeah.
But in any case, I did that. I was thrown out, and then I told my parents, you know, I'd really like to continue my studies in Germany. I was fluent in German. They had absolutely nothing against that because, quite frankly, they didn't want me around. It was a reminder of the embarrassment that I was causing them with the family. They were ashamed of me.
Right.
So I applied to several universities, decided to go to Munich because I also had some family there. And this was the year of the 72 Olympics. And so off I went to Munich and waited for further instructions. And that takes us up to when the very first missions then start.
Okay, and before we get into that, you know, it sparked a few questions in the chat room. And kind of asking, and there was a few kind of, so I'm going to piece them together and just kind of form one.
Sure.
Or actually kind of two. One was that you talked about they were kind of feeding you stuff on the Middle East and, you know, some documents, some books and whatnot. And the question from Alav was, how were you getting those documents? Were they in the mail or, you know, was it in some kind of classroom type setting or?
Oh, no. That was always hand delivered by, for lack of a better word, what I will call my handler, the person who is responsible for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was always hand-delivered.
Okay. And then it kind of along those lines as well, did you ever feel at any time that maybe, you know, these books and some of the things they may have been telling you in any way was maybe it was, you know, it was like brainwashing, and someone had brought up Catcher in the Rye.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with Catcher in the Rye?
I am.
Okay.
But, you know, at the time, I didn't ever even consider brainwashing, because had I considered that, I would have certainly been a little bit more reticent about doing all of this. I would have thought about what's going on here. But if it was, I certainly didn't consider it at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We'll get into your first mission here in just a second. I've got a few other questions myself.
Okay.
Then I kind of want to get there. At any time, or you know, I guess, did you ever see yourself, you know, as a murderer, or was this really for the country?
That's a really good question, because at the time, I honestly thought it was really for the country, because if I had not thought that, I could have never gone through with this. Now, it has been brought up on other interviews also. How do I know that I wasn't just being used by a corrupt U.S. agency to further their own, whether they be drug deals, whatever, get their own vengeance, get rid of people who were standing in the way? You know, that's always possible. But I don't have any evidence pointing to that, but I certainly can't discount it. However, had I labored under that suspicion at the time, I couldn't have gone through with it, because I considered myself, and the way it was explained to me, maybe that was part of the brainwashing,
right.
I considered myself a soldier without a uniform. It's very simple. There are places that the U.S. needs to go into and get a job done, where if they were to send military people, uniformed soldiers, it would cause an international incident, possibly a war. So that's where you send someone like me who represents the country but is not in uniform. Now, when you take a young person who enlists or is drafted or whatever into any of the military services, whether they do it to be a clerk, a computer technician, a medic, a mail person, a mechanic, whatever they get taken for, the bottom line mission of that person is that when necessary, when called upon, they will kill the enemy. So you have this young female computer technician, let's say, and she can be put in the position in Iraq or wherever they might be, Afghanistan, of shooting a person across a field of battle. Now, do you call that soldier a murderer? Yes, I know many people would, and there are different, you know, schools of thought in the U.S. that any killing is murder and that the military has no place in modern society. I understand that. But most people would not call that soldier a murderer. When you send a pilot out to take out what might be a safe haven for terrorists, whatever, and he drops that bomb, unless you hear in the news, of course, that instead they took out 18 children or whatever, do you call that pilot a murderer? Generally not. You generally give them a medal, say good job, and promote them.
Exactly.
So why, then, when someone is trained like me to do these military activities without the uniform, yet with the sponsorship of the government, am I termed an assassin? You know, I didn't pick that word. The assassin word was picked by the publisher because, quite frankly, it's a catch. You know, people walk by and say, ooh, assassin.
Yeah.
It looks good. But then again, however much I might dislike the word, I also understand that any word they could come up with is simply going to be a euphemism for murderer, for killer.
Right.
I mean, if you get down to basic language, that's what it is. Someone who kills is a killer. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, do I deserve to use euphemisms? I don't know. But, again, I didn't look at it as being a killer, a murderer. I took out some very nasty people who themselves had killed many, if not hundreds or thousands of others, and in my mind, I was removing that threat, the very active threat.
Right. And, you know, yeah, I could, you know, definitely understand that. You know, I mean, if I can no way put myself in your shoes, but, you know, if I could imagine it, I could see, you know, someone thinking definitely it's all for country. We've got one, let's get this question in the chat room, and we'll definitely get into when you went on your first assignment. And this question is coming from Dr. Gary Frick, and he's asking, what did you tell your family all those years that you were in the CIA?
I was always provided a very good cover job. Initially, when I was in Munich, my cover was a student. Now, when you go to school in a place like Munich, the university, first of all, it's government subsidized by the German government, so I basically paid 15 marks, which at the time was about $4 for my tuition. The rest was paid by the government. In most German universities, they do not test. Now, what I mean by that is you sign up for a course, it gets entered onto your records, and you do not take tests in that course until it's time to graduate. Then they ask you, well, what are we going for today, bachelor's, master's, doctorate? And then the test you take will be according to the level you want to graduate at, and you take a test on every course you ever took. Much different than the U.S. system, you know, much higher suicide rate in Europe, because after 4 years of partying, people sit down and go, oh, my God, I've got to take this massive test. Whereas in the States, you know, you get statistics out of the way as a freshman, you quickly flush it out of your mind, never to look at it again, hopefully. So it was very easy to be registered as a student and not be there, because there's no attendance taken. You're simply registered in the course. So you could be gone months at a time. Nobody would really care.
Yeah.
So that was my cover initially. Later on, you know, I had other missions. As I got older, I was actually an instructor for Central Texas College, for University of Maryland, for Boston College, for Central Texas College, teaching soldiers in Europe, which would require me to be in different cities from the one I lived in, which made it easy for me to tell my wife, well, I've got to go there for some weeks, whatever. But I always had a good cover position, which would explain why I was not at home.
And I guess that was tough. I mean, having to tell, I mean, not only your parents, but your wife.
Well, my wife came along later. You know, I was already in my 30s before I had to deal with my wife. And it's really not that hard. Well, first of all, I don't want to sound callous. Yes, I was living a lie. Obviously, I had a double life. Obviously, I did not tell her the truth. Obviously, but it isn't like, you know, I was running out having affairs, robbing banks, addictions, anything like that. I was leading a double life for a purpose. And the cover job I had when I was with my wife in Germany was actually with the Army. They got me a job as site commander for Conventional Forces Europe Treaty. I was in treaty compliance, which again gave me the opportunity to travel to East Bloc countries to ensure compliance. And my wife knew that for that job I had a top secret clearance and that I couldn't talk about it. So again, it was a perfect cover in that she knew, even if she asked, she wasn't going to get an answer out of me. Now, there were definitely close calls. I pulled a defection from East Germany once of a couple of Spetsnaz, that Soviet Special Forces officers, and the defection went bad. The people I was supposed to hand them off to changed their mind. Those were the U.S. forces, supposedly my friends. And I ended up with these two Russians and their family sitting in my house, and which was only 12 kilometers from the East German border. And I called my folks, and they said, well, we've changed your mind. This one is too politically hot. These guys would cause an international incident. My answer was, well, what do you want me to do with them? Take them back? You know, it's hard enough getting them out without trying to sneak back over into East Germany. So they said I could give them to the German authorities. I called the German authorities, friends I had there, and, of course, they snapped them up. But first they came to the house. They surrounded the house with German special forces, special, you know, automatic weapons, et cetera, police, helicopters. My wife was teaching aerobics on the military installation close to our house, and she was coming home wondering what all the brouhaha was. Then she saw that it was centered at our house. She came in, she looked around and said, my God, what's going on here? And my answer was simply, Well, you know, I was walking downtown Fulda, a small town close to us, and I ran into these Russian guys, and they didn't speak any German, and since I speak Russian, and I told them I'd help them out. Now, people sit out there and they say, my God, was she that naive, that ignorant? It's not a question of naivety or ignorance. What is she supposed to think?
Right.
Oh, my husband must be a spy. That's even more ignorant. So the answer that I gave her worked. Now, since reading the book, she's come across several of those incidents where she just shakes her head and says, yeah, this answers a lot.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, we've got about 8 minutes before we take a break. And I really don't want to get in right into something, so we'll take our break a little early. And that way when we come back from it, we can get into your first assignment, and we won't have to kind of cut out part of it there or interrupt you. So sound like an idea?
That's fine.
All right. Well, we're going to take that quick little break. Then everyone tuning in, as we always do, we'll just break here for about 6 minutes or so. So don't go anywhere. We're going to continue to speak with Roland Haas here about just, I mean, his secret life as a CIA assassin, very fascinating, interesting story. And we're going to get into some of what he done in that position. So don't go anywhere. And, of course, he doesn't join us tonight, Superior Awesomeness. I decided to put some throat singing in our break tonight. And what do you know, he doesn't join us, but I'm sure we'll all enjoy it instead. So back in a few minutes.
Visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today to sign up for our free newsletter, join as a member of our forum, or browse our online store where you can find books, CDs, and DVDs, like a signed copy of The President's Vampire by Robert Damon Schneck, or the complete works of Dr. Gary Frick for only $20. That's 4 books signed by Dr. Frick that carry a great message. You also find downloadable products like Mysteries Magazine and the Donald Kehoe interviews, DVDs featuring Charlie Carlson and Mr. Lobo. So go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today and be a part of the show.
Well, welcome back, everyone. You are tuned into Shadows in the Dark, broadcasting live right here on Blog Talk Radio, also syndicated on Black Vault Radio Network at blackvaultradio.com and ParaX at para-x.com. Now, I want to let everyone know that if you wish to call in, our calling number is 718-508-9887. All right, Roland, before we get into this first assignment that you were given, give us one time your website, and again, the name of your book that you have put out.
Okay, the name of the book is Enter the Past Tense. The reason I called it that was because that when I first signed on with the CIA, once I went on my first mission, the person I was ceased to exist. I mean, Roland Haas just literally entered the past tense.
Mm-hmm.
The new person came out. And the website is www.enterthepasttenseoneword.com. And on that site, I will make one offer to people. First of all, I do not sell my books. This is, you know, I did not self-publish as a real publisher. It's done by Amazon. It's done by Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, all these other bookstores. But if people want to send me an email with a question, they can certainly do that through my site, and I will answer every one of them personally, maybe not necessarily immediately because it takes some time, but I'm certainly willing to answer questions along those lines too.
All right, wonderful. And if anyone has any trouble finding the website or the book, we have it all linked from our website as well, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. Now, Roland, is this your first assignment? Is this where Phil comes in, or is this someone?
Phil came in right at the beginning. He's the person who recruited me, and like I said, was my handler.
So Phil was your handler.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about your first assignment then.
Well, one day walking along away from the University of Munich, Phil falls in the step next to me. He always freaked me out that way. I mean, it didn't matter where I was, he knew where I was. And he said we had a talk. We went to a place in Munich called the Matheza, which is the Löwenbräu Beer Hall, which seats like 8,000 people. And it's a perfect place to talk because it's a tourist spot and people are talking all kinds of languages and it's noisy and they're all drinking beer. and anything you say is not likely to be overheard by anybody else. We got there, they pulled out an envelope with some pictures, some names, addresses, and what I was supposed to do is I was supposed to make my way east, going through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, then into India, and back, and along the way, eliminate some people. And when I asked why, he said this was a first eye-opener for me as far as, you know, living in and working for a country that is not always as idealistic or honest as you would like. His explanation was that the people I was going to be dealing with were people in the drug trade, various stages of the drug trade, from growers to distributors, whatever. But he explained that in many instances, the U.S. and certainly the agency supports drug trade because it's a way to get money into the hands of insurgent groups who we would like to see in power.
Right.
So, but normally that doesn't involve the drugs coming into the United States. They just go other places. Now, there were some people working with the agency. They had their protection as far as growing the stuff, distributing it, manufacturing it. But they'd gotten greedy. In other words, they were also selling off to other people and going into distribution in the U.S. So they had to be eliminated. And that's where I came in. Again, you can't very well, at that time, you couldn't very well send in troops to Iran or Afghanistan and expect them to live longer than 5 minutes.
Right.
So what I did was I joined the hippie trail. I headed eastward. First stop, Istanbul, which was where a person in the distribution chain was. And after a certain amount of time, I did make contact, and we did talk business. He thought I was the person there, that I was, although looking like a hippie, to fit in, that I had lots of money, and I was there to make a deal. And, of course, having already demonstrated his greediness, he was more than willing to do that. But I told him I could not finalize the deal yet. I still had some things to do further east. He didn't like that idea because he thought I might cut him out of anything. But I left it at that. I made my contact and I moved on. Traveling across Turkey, got into Iran. Now, Iran is interesting. When you get to the borders, at least at that time when you got to the borders, there were signs on the borders that said anyone caught with contraband narcotics will be executed. Now, we're not saying will be tried. We're talking about will be executed. So it's interesting that cars and buses, as they approach the border, the windows come down and all kinds of paraphernalia and bags of drugs are being thrown out the windows. But interestingly enough, when they leave Iran on the other side, they get to pick up the stuff that people who are heading back west throw out their windows to avoid from being executed. It was a good symbiotic relationship there.
Right.
And again, at the time, the Shah was in power, and he was an ally of the U.S. As a matter of fact, the Central Intelligence Agency trained the SAVAK, which is the Iranian secret police. Didn't have to do anything in Iran, but I did in Afghanistan. Now we're talking about growers in northern Afghanistan in the hills. I went to Kabul, which even in good times, Afghanistan did not look pretty. I mean, it looks a lot worse now. But I went to Kabul, and there was a very vibrant Western hippie-type community in Kabul. And so going to the haunts that they used, I established myself. I set up a meeting with this guy. I was supposed to meet him at a hotel in Kabul. My line to him was that I was there to make a big buy, and I wanted to bypass anybody else in the chain. That immediately sparked the interest. It's a lot longer than I'm describing, but I only have so much time here.
Right.
And I get to the hotel, and to my shock and dismay, when I enter the room, not only is he there, but two burly brothers of his who were his bodyguards.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't care what kind of Jason Bourne movie you've seen. I don't care what kind of Bruce Lee movie you've seen. But one skinny American in a small room with three burly Afghanis spells trouble. I knew it. I mean, there's just no miraculous getting out of this, and especially since I did not have, the only weapon I had at the time was a knife. So I'm sitting there thinking, well, this is fine. Your first mission, you're going to get killed before you get anything done, because it's not going to take long for these guys to figure out I don't have money and I'm not really there to buy anything.
All right.
But again, the person I was supposed to dispatch, being a gracious host, asked me if I wanted anything to drink, anything to eat, and I said, yes, please. He sent one brother out for tea and another brother out for little Afghani pastries. I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah.
And now I'm left alone with him, and yes, I dispatched him with a knife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I knew the other two would be coming back, so you have to be very careful, and I'm not going to go into gross details over the radio. That anybody cares about that, that's in the book. But I had to be very careful that I held him and attacked in a manner that the bloodstream would go away from what would be seen when someone walks in the door.
Right.
And I did that. The other two came back. The same thing happened with the other two. And again, one-on-one is a lot easier to handle than three-on-one, which is impossible to handle. I had no time to think about what I was doing. I had no time to hesitate, because at that point, if you hesitate even for a second, these people are people who dealt in these kind of things for ages, and they will pick up on that, and the person who's going to be killed is going to be you. I did what I needed to do, and I knew a bus was leaving. There were a lot of tour buses, I mean, just for the locals even. Was leaving from Kabul, going across the Khyber Pass into Pakistan. I made it to that, got on the bus, trembling the whole way, wondering what was going to happen. But I had done this deed in such a way that it would look like it was part of, let's call it a tribal feud. Afghanistan is made up of a lot of different tribes, and they're in competition with each other when it comes to drug trade. And they hate each other, which is one reason they're never going to unify that country. They can't get along. And so I made it look like it was possibly a tribal vendetta thing going on.
Hmm.
I was lucky. No suspicion ever came upon me, not that I expected it to. Got on the bus, crossed the Khyber Pass, got into Pakistan. And then it hit me that I had just killed three people. And I didn't feel any remorse. I didn't feel any shame, disgust, anything. The only thing I felt was an elation at success of a mission. I removed three drug dealers.
Right.
I hear again, people have come up to me since then and said, how do you know that they weren't just a thorn in the side of the CIA and they just wanted them out of the way for that reason? I don't know. Because just like a soldier who's given an assignment, if I stop to question, I'm not the guy making the plans here. I'm the doer. I'm given an order. I carry it out. If the lowest guy in the totem pole starts asking questions, discipline, order falls apart, and you've got all kinds of problems. Made it into Pakistan, stayed with a person I had met within Kabul, who was a bus driver, for a while, kind of recover, then went into India, had some interesting things there, but nothing to do with missions, just dealing with people, and then started my way back east, because I had these people in Turkey to take care of.
Mm.
Now, I was left to get my own transportation. I couldn't be staying at swanky hotels. I couldn't be flying in and out of places, because that draws too much attention.
Right.
So, everywhere I went, I would stop in the local American Express office, which at the time was the way that kids from the West got messages, money, etc., from their families back in the States or in Europe, whatever the case might be. And that's how I got my messages, that's how I got my money, that's how I got my assignments from the agency, from Phil, always coded to an American Express office. I went to the American Express office in Delhi when I was through with India, and I noticed a card. Somebody was traveling back toward Vienna, had a Mercedes van. They were a documentary filmmaker, is what he described himself as, and he wanted someone to share the driving and share the costs. I figured this is ideal. I did that. We get into Afghanistan. Of course, I'm worried the whole way through Afghanistan because I don't know if there was any suspicion. Make it to the border, make it over the border to Iran, and the next thing I knew, I was hit from behind in the kidneys, as was the person who owned the van, and soundly beaten. And what I found out was, here I am, the supposed big drug interdiction guy. I had just hitched a ride with a drug dealer. The sides of his van were packed with heroin.
Oh, my gosh.
And the country that said you will be executed.
Right.
I thought, well, this sucks. We're taking off to a prison. And I was told to sign something. Now, I do a lot of languages. Persian Farsi isn't one of them. And I'm not about to sign anything I don't understand because I know that it's probably a confession just to tidy things up.
Right.
At which point I will be executed. I don't sign it. Now the other guy does, and he's immediately executed. Okay, so that takes care of that. So for a period of a couple weeks, every day, all night, with very few breaks, beaten, and poked and prodded in ways I really don't even care to remember anymore. I didn't expect any miraculous rescue, white knights in shining armor riding up the cavalry to rescue me, because I knew the deal. I just wanted to put off the execution part for as long as possible. One day they come up to me and they say, okay, we're tired of this. We caught you, did the rites. So we're just going to go ahead with the execution. They lead me out to a courtyard, and in the courtyard, the wall that surrounds this prison has little rings in the wall. Those were to tie up camels, horses, whatever, in the past. And they shackle my hands to one of the rings facing outward, and they march out a firing squad. And like I said, I don't understand Persian Farsi, but it's not too hard to figure out the ready aim fire part of what language they're using.
Yeah.
When the rifles are suddenly trained at your head.
Yeah.
And at that point, you know, I really didn't care because I was hurt. I had left Germany at 225 pounds. I was now down to 150.
Goodness.
And had trouble walking, or I was bleeding from every place I could think of to bleed from, and I was ready to die. And on the fire command, they did indeed fire, but they fired on both sides of my head. This was a last-ditch attempt to get me to confess.
Right.
What my mind did is it threw up its natural defenses, and it caused me to pass out. I mean, it was just too much for my head to handle. I just literally went under. When I woke up, I was in a small hotel in Tehran, capital city of Iran. And I was to find out later, I didn't know how any of this came about, but when anyone is picked up, an American is picked up for drug dealing, word is sent back to the consulate, to the Central Intelligence Agency, and the parents. Not that they can do anything about it, but just to let them know, hey, Johnny's not coming home.
Right, yeah.
But again, the SAVAK was trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, when my name got back there, all of a sudden, you know, bells went off. Hey, he works for us. And so it was kind of like a rescue, the cavalry coming. Not the way I expected. It took a couple weeks for that to happen.
Right.
By staying alive, I managed to ensure that I would keep staying alive. Now I'm in Tehran. I'm broken. I'm having trouble walking. But I still have to go back to Istanbul and complete my mission there. And that was the distributor. Now, at that point, we're dealing with much more sophisticated people than mountain people in Afghanistan. It took a little longer. Again, I reestablished the connections. And I didn't set up a meet. We just talked for a while. But I followed him. I knew where the man lived. And I simply went to what he used as his safe house. Because these people don't bring their business home to their wives and kids. It's a totally separate thing. He had a house in a resort area outside of Istanbul. I broke into the house after I watched them leave in the morning, and I waited for them to return, and the guys came in. He came in with his bodyguards. This time I did have a 45 with silencer, and that took care of that. it's a lot easier to take care of four people when you have the element of surprise, because three of them are dead before the fourth knows anything's happening.
Right.
And at that point, I went back into Istanbul and caught a train west going through Romania, Bulgaria, and finally into Italy, where I was going to try and recover from all of this, which I did. And then I headed back up to Germany, got there, and when I met Phil and he again explained to me how all this came about and why I was still alive, I was both angry and, of course, relieved. And I told him, you know, I would really, really like to go back and finish a degree at some university to give my parents some kind of semblance of honor here that I redeemed myself.
Mm-hmm.
He asked me if that meant I was quitting. No, I'm not quitting. I just want to do this. He said, under those conditions, fine. He recommended I apply back to Purdue. And I reminded him, hey, look, they told me never to come back. They told me to stay out of the state, as a matter of fact.
Right.
I don't see this happening. And he said, look, I'll get you the paperwork. You send it in. Let's see what happens. And that's, again, when I was not only accepted, I was given a full scholarship, made a dorm counselor, which just freaked the hell out of me.
Yeah.
But again, it just showed what they could do. I got my degree. I finished a master's, and I actually went to UC Berkeley to do a PhD in comparative literature. It got to the point, though, where I had to go back to Europe and go back to work, which brings up the second round of missions. Do you have any questions? I don't want to just be the one talking.
No, that's fine. That's what, you know, they're listening for you, not me. So, I do have a few questions. Now, did they ever give you reasons why you were doing each mission? Did you know the reason why someone was being taken out?
You know, I learned after asking on the first one and being told something that didn't sound totally right, like they weren't keeping up their part of the bargain, it does no good to question, because they will have an answer, whether it's a true answer or not. And if the only reason you're asking is to kind of soothe your conscience, if you know that it's not necessarily the right answer, the whole question about soothing your conscience goes out the window. So why ask? It wasn't my question to know or understand. It wasn't my place to know or understand, excuse me.
No.
That wasn't my job in this. I was just a doer. No more than a private or a sergeant in the Army goes up to the general and asks, why are we trying to take that city?
Right.
You have to explain it to me before I go. Well, he's not going to last long.
Yeah. So, yeah, so you're a soldier with an order.
Right.
Right. Wow. And now, when you went on these missions, did you ever, did you ever have a fear of retaliation from, those who, say, like, you took out the drug dealer? Did you ever have fear of retaliation from, his entourage, I guess you could call it, or, his people?
Well, not really, because when you think about it, and people have asked me once the book was out, do I fear retribution? In the first instance, we're talking about Afghani mountain people.
Mm-hmm.
Are they ever going to read this book? No. The chances of anybody from back then still being alive in a country where the life expectancy is about half of what it is in America to begin with, and that's if you don't get killed in a feud, is very remote. And even if someone did read that and say, oh, so that's what happened to Grandpa Omar or whatever his name was, I don't see them showing up on my doorstep, a la a Kurt Vonnegut novel, Slaughterhouse 5, someone showing up on your doorstep 40 years later seeking revenge. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, and I was, what about along the lines of when, shortly after, say, the hit took place? Did you always feel that you covered, your tracks well enough that you didn't have to worry about someone knowing who you were and retaliating, say within a week after, back to the drug lord, say a week after that?
Well, had I hung around for a week, that was always a possibility. but I had always done my research. I knew when I was going to act, and I always set up the time to act so that I would have time to do what I needed to do, get back, and get on whatever transportation I had set up. Istanbul is close to the border. I mean, once I finished there, I caught a train. I was out of the country within a half an hour. Afghanistan, I caught a bus, and it took a little longer, but still, we're not dealing with FBI as far as law enforcement over there is concerned. The first thing they're going to think is tribal feuds or a drug war or whatever. There'd be no reason to suspect someone just wandering through the country. And I never took their money. I never took their drugs.
Right.
So that made it look like a feud thing rather than a wandering hippie who wants just the heroin or the opium or the hashish or whatever it was they were doing at the time.
So, yeah, so I guess it would be safe to say then that pretty much, you know, some of your cover was that country's own conflicts.
Sure.
Wow.
You have to use the tools you're given, and that's certainly one of them.
Wow. All right, here's a question. Let me get a couple questions from our chat, and I got one from Instant Message, and then, you know, we'll go on to the second assignment here. And the one from the chat was asking, you know, do you ever distort your voice? And, I mean, I can say I've not put anything in place to distort your voice, and you also make public appearances, don't you?
I don't distort my voice. I don't hide my face. I am what I am. I've done what I've done. The picture on the cover of a book is me. The one picture is me at 19 when I first went into Afghanistan, and then the second one is me now. My wife designed the cover, and it's just kind of a morph from what I was then into what I am now. No, I don't hide anything.
Mm-hmm. And like I say, so you, if I'm not mistaken, I've seen a video where I think you were in like a little bookstore or a coffee shop talking with people.
That was filmed for Book TV on C-SPAN, right. That was in New York City. They invited me up to do that. They filmed for an hour and 15 minutes. That's what the whole segment was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was certainly me.
Oh, well, good, good. And it's, yeah, somebody had asked if that was actually your picture on the book, so that answered that.
No, that so, definitely is.
Yeah. Now, and this is a question, and of course that question was from Dr. Gary Frick again there, and we've got another one from Alav who was asking, I guess, do you feel that the CIA kind of screwed you, I guess, in terms of identity and kind of didn't give you a new identity, just kind of dropped you, didn't they?
They did. And yes, there was a certain amount, there is a certain amount of anger. And, I was not happy at all the way they did me. But as it became clear to me, when you're doing the kinds of things that I did for them, your life expectancy is not a long one.
Right.
And they figure, you know, if you can complete 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 missions before you're killed, then those things that you did are more easily swept under the rug, and a new person comes in and does his turn in the box, gets killed, etc. I did something they didn't expect, which is I lived for 30-some years doing this.
All right.
Now, people have asked me, they said, oh, my God, you must have been really well-trained and really good at what you did. Well, you know, that's just a small part of it. Luck played such a tremendous role. If I would have breaking into this house in Istanbul, had someone turned the corner at the wrong time, had someone been left in the house that I didn't know about, if those two brothers in Afghanistan didn't leave that room,
right,
all of those would have been disasters and I would have been dead. I mean, I can't win the damn lottery, but I could sure do that, it seemed. You know, I was real lucky in getting out of situations like that.
Right. That's a good
maybe
point.
It's just I've used all my luck up. I don't know.
Now, you had mentioned, you know, kind of going somewhere to pick up a package that had money. Were you ever equipped for any of your missions? I know you said, you know, your first assignment, all you had was a knife.
Right, because that's something I could travel with and I could cross borders with. By the time I got back to Istanbul, I had to use a pistol, a 45. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, I had been given directions in I picked them up at the American Express office in Ankara in Turkey, which is halfway through Turkey. And it said, when I get to Istanbul, I was to check into a certain hotel. I believe it was a Hilton. And that the desk will have been alerted that my parents were going to pay for this. And they had been given a credit card number, so I was to be given a room no matter what I looked like. And when I got there and checked in, the person at the desk, although he didn't like the way I looked, because, quite frankly, you know, people in Afghanistan don't bathe, hardly ever.
Right.
And it's just as hard for Westerners to do that if you're not living in hotels.
Right.
He gave me a note, which was supposedly from my parents. And there was a key in the note, which was from Phil. The key was to an Opel Kadett Rally Sport. Now, when I was at Purdue, I drove a gold Opel Kadett Rally Sport. So, again, I'm not supposed to be dim-witted about these things. I know that when Westerners get to Turkey, to Istanbul, they generally park their vehicles in a place called the Hippodrome, which had hundreds of Western German cars especially, and then they would proceed eastward, either in groups or on bus or whatever. So I took the key, I went to the Hippodrome, and I wandered around, and doggone it, there was a gold Opel Kadett Rally Sport. It looked just like the car I had had. The key fit. I opened the door. Under the seat was a box with the .45 in it and the silencer.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the weapon I needed without having to cross borders for it.
All right. Wow. All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Roland Haas. He is author of Enter the Past Tense, My Secret Life as a CIA Assassin. And one more time, before we and then we'll get into your second assignment, give that web address once more, so anyone who's new, just tuning in, we've got a few more joined us in the chat room, so they'll know they can check it out.
Sure, www.enterthepasttenseoneword.com. And again, I'll be glad to answer, within my abilities, any emails that are posted to that site.
Mm-hmm. Now, and that's a good question, kind of, you say within your abilities. Are there some things that you can't talk about?
There are things that I won't talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is I will not talk about anything recent or that might still be ongoing. Because what that does is it jeopardizes people out there in the field doing what I did. I was approached early on, contacted, let me put it that way, early on by 60 Minutes when I had written this book, and they wanted to interview me. And I thought, okay, I can do this. And what they said is, but, you know, we're 60 Minutes. We want something spectacular. We want something that'll just blow the socks off the government. Can you tell us who exactly authorized these missions? Because I also did a lot of work in Guantanamo Bay, the detention facility there. I helped set up the interrogation facilities, as a matter of fact, under the capacity of my current cover job, which is Deputy Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Army Reserve Command.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I'd get fired once the book came out, once the Reserve Command understood that, although they were paying me, someone else was using me. But they haven't done that. They've been really good about this. But in that job, I went and set up a lot of what happened in Guantanamo. What 60 Minutes wanted for me was names. They wanted to drop a dime on Rumsfeld, you name it, they wanted the names.
Yeah.
I refused to do that. Judith Reagan, who did the O.J. Simpson book, offered a ton of money to publish my book if I were to do the same thing. And I had to explain, you know, I could not do that and live with myself. I will not be the cause of another person's death, first of all. Second, so you're going to give me a ton of money, which will then get me sent to jail because I will have divulged current top secret things, which I'm not supposed to do. And so my wife, whom I love very much, will now have all this money to spend while I'm in prison for the rest of my life.
Right.
Now, that doesn't sound like a good deal to me.
Yeah.
But for a number of reasons, I would not do that. And that's true till today. I do know to a great extent what is going on, what is involved, where things are happening. And if it's at all currently classified or if it would at all jeopardize anybody working today. I'm just not interested. All right. I will not talk about that.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into your second assignment then.
Well, now I'm back in Europe, and I'm going to be used. I was doing defections, which means I was dropped into East Germany, getting people out of East Germany. When all of a sudden, I was told that, I don't know if you're familiar with the group called the Baader-Meinhof gang. They were very active in Germany during the 80s, and they were a leftist, if not anarchist, communistic group. And what they were doing was they were placing bombs in U.S. military installations in Europe, in shopping exchanges, in schools, and they were blowing up little kids, families, et cetera, et cetera. And our folks had figured out that one of the people at the beginning of that chain, there were three of them exactly, some very good-looking young ladies who in Frankfurt, which is where a large concentration of our troops were, and their job was to go to bars to pick up American soldiers under the offer of big party, booze, and sex, and get them back to their apartment. Now, I don't know if you've known many soldiers, but you send a soldier into a bar, and a girl's job is to convince him to come back to her apartment for sex and booze. That's not a hard job. They were very successful in what they did. Unfortunately, when they got these soldiers back to their apartment, they would kill them, and they would use their IDs then to gain access into the installations where they could do what they were doing. We figured out who these three were. Unfortunately, someone tipped them off that, yes, their cover was blown, and so they ran from Frankfurt into East Germany because it was a safe place to hide. Again, we're not going to send soldiers in to get them.
Right.
Again, that's where someone like me comes in. I was told that I had to go in and hopefully talk to these three women and find out how things were happening, or, barring that, to kill them. Well, I did get in. I was parachuted in. Again, everything that happened is in the book. Mm-hmm. I approached them in a bar and just tried to make small talk, and I couldn't get a word out of them, and it was clear to me that they were so devoted, dedicated to what they were doing. They weren't going to risk that for anything. So the only thing left to do was to kill them, which I did. And, hey, what can I say? People have asked me, how can you say you killed good-looking young women? Isn't there something wrong with this to kill a woman? And I said, you can't think of them as women when they are setting bombs that are killing families, children, et cetera. You know, they're evil. What can I say?
Right.
And so I had absolutely no problem doing that. Mm. And what I had done was I knew the bar they went to every night. So one night I went to the bar. They had their little Trabi, which was the East German vehicle, Trabant, which is like a little wooden car. And I put reflective tape under the driver's window, went down the route they had to take to drive back to where they were staying. When I saw it coming, I shine a light. The reflective tape reflects. I shoot, I hit the driver in the forehead, she's dead. Car crashes, the other two are not dead. I go up, I shoot them, and then set the car on fire to make it look like maybe they were just drunk and had an accident. Whether or not they checked on holes in the head, I don't know.
Right.
But it's a lot easier to accept the fact that they had just had an accident. After that, most of what I was used for was, again, defections. I was used to go in and get information from dissidents, from disenchanted, let me put it that way, Soviet soldiers who did not want to go back to the Soviet Union as their troops redeployed back. And I became a courier of sorts. And to me, that was much more satisfying. Didn't have to kill anybody.
Right.
Unfortunately, in one of the instances when I was trying to get somebody out, we were being chased by an East German policeman. I pulled over. I figured it was for speeding, and because Trabis don't go that fast. As he came up to the window of the car, I simply shot him in the chest, and we went on, and I got my person back to the West. Whatever happened to these people, for the most part, I don't know. Again, that was my job.
Right.
So I handed them over to who I was supposed to hand them over to, and on I went.
Hmm. Now, how many assignments or missions did you go on throughout your, would you say it was 30, 35 years?
Well, an awful lot of assignments. Actual assassinations, 18.
18?
I describe 11 of them in the book.
Wow.
The others for reasons I've already explained I won't.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, were these, you know, were all these more or less drug dealers, or were any of these, you know, assassinations for any kind of political gain or to sway anything?
You know, again, I don't always know the reasons.
Right.
If they were for political gain, at this point, I would certainly not admit it on the radio because that's just not my job.
Right.
Again, to get anybody in trouble. Initially, they were, again, drug dealers. After that, they were members of communist factions working in West Germany. And after that, that gets into the realm where I just can't talk about it.
Oh, understandable. Very understandable. Now, were you locked in any way, or could you walk away from it at any time?
You know, I could walk away, and I pretty much did that when I came back and went to school, because although I said I was just going to get a bachelor's, I hung around for the master's and then went out to Berkeley to do a PhD in comparative literature. But what happened out there is Sonny Barger, if you know the name, was president of the Hells Angels.
Mm-hmm.
My partner in a health club that I had started, again, as a cover, I was given money to do this just to bring in income. He got his money because he knew a friend of Sonny's who lent him $10,000 cash, and then later came back and said, now Sonny wants a favor from you, and that is you put him on your books, the payroll, so that he has a way to justify where he's making money, because he didn't pay taxes up till then, and the feds were always after him. So all of a sudden, I've got Sonny Barger in the gym. And again, a certain bit of naivety, he would come into my office, he'd talk about people that, you know, they had killed. I'm wondering, why is Sonny telling me this?
Yeah.
Well, one day he walks in and says, you know, from now on, you guys are working for me. Excuse me? This is my club. No, no, no. We'll pay you, and we'll pay you well, but we are going to do the books, and we will run the club. What they wanted to do was launder methamphetamine money, because if it was cocaine or methamphetamines on the West Coast, it was Hell's Angels.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that idea. I was fairly large at the time. Sonny's not a big guy, but he has a lot of big, mean people working for him. And so I threw him out of the club. Someone turned to me and said, you know, that was probably a really big mistake. He turned out to be right. A couple days later, I was shot in the arm going to the gym. And a few days after that, I'm standing on my, at that time, girlfriend, soon-to-be wife, Marilyn's balcony, and I look down and I see a guy with a rifle aimed up at my head. Instinctively, I put my hands up, and the shot rang out and took off two fingers on my left hand. Now, those have been reattached. They look pretty good. You can still see the scar. I mean, they're very definitely fake fingers. And I was at the hospital. For any shooting, the police are called. The hospital has to do that. So Oakland policeman comes in. I tell him my story. And he says, you can't tell that story. I said, why not? That's what happened. He said, look, those are my friends who are not on Hell's Angels payroll are afraid of them. Either way, you stick to that story, you're going to lose. I said, no, this is bullshit. Bull, excuse me.
Okay.
I will stick that's the story as it is. So I wrote out the story, signed it. Well, the next day they arrested my sister in case she shot me. Then they arrested my girlfriend in case she shot me. And then they came to arrest me on suspicion of shooting my own fingers off.
Uh-huh.
So I quickly got the idea. The FBI showed up and offered to put me on a witness protection program, which posed other problems. First of all, I work for the CIA. My God, they don't know that. And the CIA wasn't about to come to my aid in a domestic situation like that. And the FBI explained that what they would do is put me on a witness protection program. And I asked them what that meant, and they said that means you'll probably live another 3 to 4 years, at which point they'll find you, and they'll kill you, because if you testify, they're really going to be pissed.
Yeah.
And I said, well, if that's all you can do, I don't know anything. And I refused to say anything that Sonny had talked about in the office. And the only safe thing to do was to head back to Germany. And it's at that point where Bill falls back into line and says, are you ready to come back to work? I did not go back there with the intent of going back to work, but I was working then as a bouncer in a VFW club called the House of Lights in Kitzingen, Germany. And one night, a knife fight broke out. There were two factions in the club that night, a redneck group who wanted to play their country western music, mm-hmm. and a black group that wanted to play their rap. Well, it degenerated into a knife fight. Bill had walked in just before that and asked me if I was ready to come back to work. I said, no, you know, I've got a family now. I really don't think I can do that. That's when the knife fight breaks out. That's when the owner comes up to me and says, Roland, break that up. That's when Roland, who hasn't lost his mind yet, and this, again, this is not a Bruce Lee movie, decides he's not going to step into the middle of a knife fight. And I left the bar with Jim, with Phil,
mm-hmm.
and I was back to work.
Mm. Now,
go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to say, you know, what was the point? And just to let you know, we've got about 15 minutes or so left. Time just flies. At what point did you change the outlook on life? It's, I mean, we talked earlier on in the show about you just had this, you know, attitude that just, you know, didn't care. You had no regard for life. You were a loner. What changed it? What went it all turn around?
Probably having the family. You know, we went back to Germany. My daughter was born. And soon after she was born, I was back in East Germany working again. And I thought, well, you know, if I get killed now, again, the only line the family's going to get is, oh, he must have been involved in drugs. He got killed over there. I didn't want to leave that legacy. And then what happened is the wall came down, the Iron Curtain, and there was no real need to have a person like me going, sneaking in and out when you can now just walk across the border. So I had to come back to the States. And here again, it just shows how versatile the CIA can be. I said, I just don't know what I'm going to do. This is what I'm trained for. And they said, well, here's a job that just opened in Atlanta. It's for Deputy Director of Intelligence for the U.S. Army Reserve Command. I kind of laughed. I said, you know, that carries a civilian rank that's the equivalent of a colonel.
Yeah.
How am I going to qualify for that job? I've never had a job. I'm a down-and-dirty field guy. This is a management. This is policy, etc. This is, you know, ordering other people in the battle. This is a whole different ballgame. They say, oh, go ahead and apply. Same story I heard with school. Well, I applied, but in the meantime, I heard that someone had already accepted the job. Well, doggone it, if that person didn't change their mind, doggone it if I didn't get the job. Again, with absolutely no resume to back this up.
Yeah.
You know, some people... There have been, of course, some people who are who question the book's veracity, credibility, and I say all you have to do is look at these few instances that are a matter of public record.
Yes.
I, with no resume, am now the Deputy Director of Intelligence for a major Army command, taking regular trips to the Pentagon outlining military intelligence policy. It's kind of scary. And then I had, like I said, the bout with the addiction with the alcoholism. When I came out of rehab, if you have a top secret clearance, you have to be revalidated, reinvestigated every 5 years. It was time for the reinvestigation.
Mm-hmm.
And the investigator comes in and asks all the normal questions. And already he's filling the form in before I'm answering, because everybody always gives the same answers. Have you ever had a problem with this? He gets to, have you ever had a problem with alcohol? He's checking no. I say yes.
Mm-hmm.
He stops, looks at me. Says, well, it was only temporary and not very severe. I said, no, I was a full-blown alcoholic, and I ended up in rehab, and yeah, that's pretty severe.
Yeah.
Stops writing, and anybody who's ever dealt with having a clearance knows that if you admit that, or if it is found out in any way, there is not a snowball's chance in hell, I don't care who you are, that you're going to get validated for a top-secret clearance. I did. even making that full admission. Again, it just shows what they can do.
Yeah.
That's why it really upset me when I asked them about a retirement, that they said they couldn't do anything. Because with all the records that they changed over these three decades, they got me my job with the Army in Europe. They got me my job with the schools. They could have just as easily gone back in, but since I was hired for the Army in Europe and I was now in the States and the installation I was hired at was no longer in existence, they could have backdated my employment record. Nobody would have been any the wiser. I would have had a regular 30-year retirement from federal service, and I would have never written a book. But when they said there was nothing I could do, that showed me there was just nothing that they were willing to do. And again, that spurred the book.
Yeah. Wow. And let me, we've got a couple other questions from the chat room. And I guess one of them, now, you said it was Deputy Director of Intelligence, is that right? Is that what you are currently doing now?
That's what I'm currently doing.
Okay, and that was the question, if you had a regular job or what exactly you were doing now. So that's
interesting, too, because if the book were phony, I would not be working there today. I mean, with the stories I tell in there, to give me a top secret clearance and entrust me with the nations, I mean, I don't just have top secret. I am cleared for sensitive compartmented information on up to nuclear and atomic. And for them to give me that kind of a clearance, that's just unheard of. I mean, under these circumstances.
Yeah. That's
yes, I do work there now.
That's a good point, too. Now this one comes from, now that was from Kismet, by the way. Now this question's from Excellen, and now he was, earlier saying in the show that he worked at the Pentagon with, I can't scroll back that far, but I think it had to do with, security. And he said at one point that the CIA approached him, offering him a job. And so his question to you was, do you think he made the right choice of turning them down?
Well, it depends on what they wanted. If his job was in security, first of all, the intelligence agencies of the United States are in heavy competition with each other. The CIA would rather have something go wrong rather than let the FBI get credit for stopping it, and vice versa. They do not share information.
Right.
That causes a lot of problems, just like with 9/11. There were agencies that knew that something wasn't right, but because that information wasn't shared and put together, it went sour. Now, if they were recruiting him because he already worked for the Army in the Pentagon, I don't know what they would have used him for, but depending on that, you know, I can't really say whether it was a good decision or not, but I would certainly say it was a good decision. Because he was already gainfully employed, and what is it they want him for?
All right. All right. Now I think this might be the last question. We got about 8 minutes, and we can go a little bit into it. But you know, really looking on me, it was so much. I mean, you know, you had a hard childhood, and you know, CIA assassinations. I mean, would you do it all again if? You know, you were back to that one day where you were called in and they said, we think you could do better for us out of uniform. Would you still say yes, knowing what was up ahead?
I would have to say yes, and for the simple reason that where I am today is, you know, I have a wife, I have two kids, good family life. Life is good. Had I said no, I would have never met my wife. Maybe would have met someone else. I don't know. But I certainly looked at it as a positive contribution. Yes, there are some things that didn't end up positively, like my own eventual addiction to alcohol. But again, that got resolved. I wouldn't change it because I like where I am today, and I think all of those steps were necessary to get where I am today.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it would be a hard choice or an easy choice?
For me, it would be an easy choice. I could not go back to that work now that my family knows. As a matter of fact, now it's to the point where if I have to go anywhere for the command I work for, you know, eyebrows go up. Are you really going to the Pentagon and things like that?
All right.
But it's just too hard living that double life. I mean, you have to constantly be ready with answers. When I left a hotel that I was supposedly staying at for my wife to call, that call was always monitored and relayed to where I really was. The person answers it and says, clean hall for hotel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They ring my room, supposedly. I answer it, but I'm nowhere near there. So it's just so hard to keep all of that straight.
Right.
Just people who have affairs, keeping it straight is difficult. This was so much more involved and so much more intense than that.
Mm. Now, and you kind of mentioned there, you know, people raising their eyebrows and saying, are you really going to the Pentagon?
Yeah.
What kind of responses, you know, have you gotten since the book's been out and now people are aware of this, you know, double life that you had?
You know, the response has been generally positive. I have had some people, again, who are skeptics, who say things like, why would the CIA take an untrained 19-year-old and send them into this situation? Well, first of all, I wasn't untrained. Second of all, why do we give 18-year-olds rifles and send them into battle? I've had special forces guys whose egos come into play and say, if the government really wanted to do this and take someone out of Afghanistan, they would have sent someone like me. No, because as much as I admire your accomplishments, you look like a soldier, you talk like a soldier, you walk like a soldier, you smell like a soldier, you're going to be dead 3 minutes after crossing that border. I mean, they needed someone who could interact with the hippie culture, with the drug culture, and get away with it. For the most part, it's been good. The Department of the Navy, which originally threw me out and gave me the dishonorable discharge, actually invited me back to Washington to speak at the Naval War Museum. That was very positive.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a few hecklers in audiences that were employees of the CIA saying that I am maligning the CIA by saying they get involved in political assassinations when they never did. And I have to remind them, don't you people read the newspaper? They've admitted that. But, you know, right. they're towing party line. They're doing what the agency can't do, which is try and cast doubt.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, it's been positive. People say the book was an easy read and that they couldn't put it down. They're asking me if there's ever going to be another one. Like I said, I am now in talks with a production company in L.A. that wanted to do a movie.
Yeah.
And this is the group that put out the Spiderwick Chronicles, so it's not a fly-by-night organization.
Wow.
And I'm asked who would I want to play me. The first answer is Don Knotts, but then he died, which ruined all of my plans. But so things are going well. Like I said, the response has been good.
That's good. And I'd say, I mean, I would love to see a movie of this myself. I mean, it's just such a fascinating story. It's interesting. It really gives, you know, some insight on what, you know, some of the things that we really don't know what's going on, and it gives some details about it. You know, you gave us a lot of information tonight, and you know, I think it would make a great movie, and I'm glad that the book is a success for you. And I definitely got to get my hands on it to read it myself. That is for sure. So one more time for us, let us know your website again and where the book is available for those out there listening.
Well, the book is available. They can go to Amazon. They can go to Barnes & Noble online. Both of them have it. It's available in most bookstores around the country, especially like Barnes & Noble and Books A Million. It was on sale in 26 different countries, last I checked, from South Africa to China to Russia. So that I find that very interesting. And the website is www.enterthepasttense.com.
All right. And now we've got just a couple minutes before we start to close out the show. So is there anything you'd like to get out there where maybe we didn't cover or any just, you know, last words to our listeners out there?
No, I really don't have anything offhand because I really don't know what the interest, you know, what things people would want to know. It's an interesting life. It's not a life for anyone. It's a life that can definitely change you and can lead you to down total destruction, or I don't know how many people have done this. You know,
there's
no club down the road, there's no BFW club or anything for old covert operatives to get together and swap stories. It just doesn't happen. I survived because I never wanted to know who else was involved, and I wouldn't let anyone else know that I was involved. What they did was none of my business, and vice versa. Because the more people that know what you do, there's an old saying in intelligence that all it takes to keep a secret is three people, as long as two of them are dead. Very true.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, definitely. And of course, if anyone listening tonight or that catches on the archives, you've mentioned a couple of times to the show, that if they, you know, have other questions, they can contact you through your website.
Email me. I will answer them.
That is wonderful. And that website again, enterthepasttense.com, correct?
Right. And again, I do not sell books, so this website is not an attempt to get anybody to send me money. Don't care. That's not my job. That's up to the bookstores. But there have been people after other shows who've sent me their books to be signed, and, you know, we can certainly make arrangements for that.
Oh, okay.
So that's not a problem.
Now, just quickly, now we had kind of, you know, talked about you did kind of a television special type thing where they videotaped. Do you do public appearances on a regular basis, or was that just kind of a one-time thing?
No, I'm constantly on the go. I've spoken to the Annapolis graduating class, out there alumni. The last one I did, believe it or not, was to the Atlanta chapter of Mensa. And I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out why they wanted me. But they did. You know, it got into the fact, you know, because of my memory and how I kept things going. So that worked fine. I addressed the American, the Romance Writers of America, you know, their annual conference, 300 women who write Harlequin romances, and they want to hear about this kind of stuff. So that was probably also a very strange one.
Yeah.
Libraries, veterans groups, it runs the gamut. I'm literally busy all the time.
Well, all right. Well, Roland, I really appreciate you taking the time to join us for this couple of hours. Like I said, just really, really interesting for you to, you know, come on and share this life that you had. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
All right. You are most welcome. So, and everybody out there who tuned in tonight, thank you so much for that. And all those in the chat room, such a great turnout there. Again, the book is Enter the Past Tense. My Secret Life as a CIA Assassin, that is Roland Haas. And visit the website, www.enterthepasttense.com. So, you know, I hope everyone enjoyed the show. And, of course, make sure to tune in this Sunday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And we're going to be joined by our conspiracy researcher, Alon Phillips. He's going to talk about Operation Gladio. If you haven't ever heard this, go out there and Google it. Get a little head start on the show if you wish. It's kind of about secret armies. It's going to be very interesting. So be sure to tune in to that. And it's also, go check out our forum, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, and you are more than welcome to check out our store as well. So again, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to Shadows in the Dark, where the darkness is illuminated. Good night, everyone.
Shadows.